Thank you. And thanks again for inviting me to present these lectures. The topic of today's lecture will be mental representation. And I will begin sharing my screen. Okay. And I begin the show.
Yes.
All right. What is mental representation? The talk will begin with some background discussion of the nature of the project of trying to situate mental representation in the natural world. And then I will relate that specifically to cognitive science and how the term gets used, just give some examples of the way it gets used in some of the scientific literature. And then I'll make a proposal about what makes something a mental representation. And this proposal is largely in response to some different forms of skepticism. Francis Egan's skepticism, Bill Ramsey's skepticism, and Hutto and Mayan's concerns. In particular, I'll talk about intentional context when sentences with co-referring terms do not remain true upon the substitution of one term for the other. They have some skeptical concerns about mental representation based on phenomena like intentionality, sometimes called opacity in philosophy of language. All right, so as you see, maybe you get the impression, part of my point here is to counter a certain kind of skepticism about mental representation. There is a lot of this coming from the more radical wing of the embodied cognition movement. And so part of what I'm addressing now, and this will come up to some extent on Thursday's lecture as well, is the role of mental representation in embodied cognitive science. All right, I want to draw a distinction that's similar to one that I was drawing at the end of yesterday's lecture. And it's a bit of background, maybe philosophical background, but I think it will set the stage well, and I can relate it to some of the concerns that have been expressed about cognitive linguistics historically. So what is naturalism? I used this term a number of times in yesterday's lecture. Ontological naturalism is one form of naturalism. Generally speaking, it's the view that the universe does not contain any supernatural entities or forces. That is not a very helpful characterization, because you ask what naturalism is and you say it's not non-naturalism, it's not supernaturalism. But we want to know what naturalism itself is and what would, say, count as supernatural in contrast. So sometimes statements of the view rely on everyday notions of physical objects, of matter or stuff in the environment, holding that only such matter exists. So people will say, as they bang on the table or they kick a rock, they say, you know, that's the stuff that exists, the real matter and stuff in the environment. And there's nothing hidden. There's no mind in nature. There's just mindless matter. The thesis can be made more precise by referring to physics. We'll say all that exists is what a completed physics includes. And this is sometimes referred to specifically as physicalism. Now, a moment ago, I said there's no mind in nature. Ultimately, nature is not made up of mind. This is how ontological naturalism is often understood. And so that's sometimes how the supernatural is characterized in contrast, in terms of kind of intelligence in the universe out there, spirits or gods or anything of that sort. And ultimately, there's a lot of deference to what science produces. In physicalism, there's deference explicitly to what physics produces. Now, as I was indicating at the end of yesterday's lecture, one might still try to find mind in the universe by seeing how it's ultimately based on the physical. But that alone doesn't really get us to the approach I'm recommending and the approach I've been taking and will continue to take which is sometimes known as methodological naturalism. Ontological naturalism puts metaphysics first, so to speak, in contrast to scientific thinking or scientific methods. The naturalism I discussed in yesterday's lecture is known as methodological naturalism, according to which our investigations of the universe are most likely to succeed, perhaps can only succeed, if they are guided by the methods of natural sciences. Now, as I indicated yesterday, these methods can be construed quite broadly. The sciences do include much theorizing, and there are places for philosophy and other very theoretically oriented endeavors as part of the sciences. But there is also a tie to experimental practice. So you see in some of the early work by cognitive linguists, a kind of appeal to intuitions about sentences, observations about various uses of sentences without collecting data in controlled experiments or doing analysis of corpuses using, say, computational linguistics methods. And so some of what I'm encouraging here throughout the cognitive sciences would apply to some of the work in cognitive linguistics and elsewhere in linguistics, which has sometimes tended not to be experimental, and sometimes critics will say too highly theoretical. Now, there is a question about ontological commitment. If one follows methodological naturalism and takes a kind of scientific approach, emphasizes scientific thinking or scientific methods, one may presumably wind up with some successful science, and ontological commitment will follow that. I mentioned an American philosopher yesterday from the mid 20th century, Willard Van Orman Quine. And Quine was very clear about this in his view, that our what we're committed to the existence of should follow successful science. If successful scientists quantify over, make reference to subatomic particles, then we should believe in subatomic particles, that sort of approach. And this could be true regardless of whether all sciences are reducible to physics. So here's a contrast with what I had in the previous slide. The ontological naturalist is very concerned to really nail the metaphysics down and commit only to things they think are somehow legitimized or legitimated by physics itself. Whereas methodological naturalists are happier to apply the methods of the natural sciences, apply scientific thinking, and follow wherever it leads. If it leads to disunified sciences that cannot be all reduced to physics, then that's okay. All right. And you see in the literature on mental content, attempt to naturalize it, to fit it into the natural world, you see some approaches or differences in approaches that parallel this difference between ontological naturalism and methodological naturalism. So in the past half century, especially in the English-speaking philosophical community, naturalistically minded philosophers have attempted to naturalize mental or representational content. I will use those two terms interchangeably here. Mental content and representational content will mean the same thing. This work has had two strands. One strand attempts to characterize the physical basis of assignments of content in a way that is sensitive to everyday psychological explanation. There's a kind of sense that when I think about horses, for example, that I know what my thought is supposed to be about. And so a naturalized theory of mental content had better assign that content to my mental structure and better kind of get that right. So the measure of success is given by our kind of intuitions about what the content of our thoughts should be. In contrast, the second strand focuses more on content determining relations that might do scientific work. It's something more like philosophy of science than philosophy of mind, you might say. And in philosophy of science, much of the emphasis is on understanding how the individual sciences work, understanding what kind of fundamental assumptions they rely on in order to succeed. Content seems to play a big role. Representations seem to play a big role in the flourishing cognitive sciences. And so this second strand of the naturalistic approach to mental content is going to look at those sciences and try to figure out how mental content or representations fit into that. And I'll be doing that today and tomorrow as well. And so I, loosely speaking, then you can see that the first strand here kind of corresponds to ontological naturalism. It's this idea that, well, we believe in mental content. We're pretty sure it exists. We don't really need a science of it. We want to make sure that somehow it's connected to the physical basis of it so that it's kind of legitimate. Whereas the second of these two strands in the naturalizing of mental content takes more of the methodological naturalist approach, says, let's just kind of approach this as a scientific issue and see whether we can sort this out by theorizing about the science or see it theorizing within the science. So to that end, I've included a list of quotations here, not for really much other reason than to give you a sense of how widely the term mental representation is used in cognitive science. It was not hard to find these four quotations. For a month or two, I just kept my eyes on whatever I was reading and jotted down a list and came up with a long list of articles in various areas of cognitive science where mental representation is used or representations are discussed. So I'll just give you a sampling of these. The first one comes from a kind of famous paper on attention and executive control in particular by Miller and Cohen. It follows, therefore, that the PFC, that's the prefrontal cortex, must maintain its activity robustly against distractions until a goal is achieved, yet also be flexible enough to update its representations when needed. It must also house the appropriate representations, those that can select the neural pathways needed for the task. The one thing executive function does is switch between tasks and marshal the appropriate resources for the task that now should be completed. Here's a quotation from a paper on memory consolidation. So the cognitive science of memory. Dudek, Carney, and Born are talking about the history of kind of work on memory consolidation, but it's a history they endorse or and are working within. They say, furthermore, the notion was revitalized that consolidation is also a generative process, resulting in modification and reconstruction of experience-dependent internal representations. And here's an example from the embodied cognition literature from the work of an influential figure, Casasanto, from his paper, Different Bodies, Different Minds, The Body Specificity of Language and Thought. And he says, to the extent that habits of body-world interaction are stable, the habits of mental representation that they encourage should be stable over time. To the extent that they change, mental representations may change accordingly. There's one last quotation I included because one of the issues that's kind of interesting, I'll only comment on a couple of times in passing, but it's a question about what mental representation has in common with other forms of representation. So another area of cognitive science in which one sees the term mental representation used is in artificial intelligence research. And so here's a quotation from the literature on machine learning, a paper by Achille and Suato, Emergence and Invariance of and Disentanglement in Deep Representations. We show that a sufficient representation of the data is invariant if and only if it is minimal. That is, it contains the smallest amount of information. The information in the representation, along with its total correlation, a measure of disentanglement, are tightly bounded by the information that weights contain about the data set. The information in the weights can be controlled by implicit and explicit regularization. Moreover, we show that adding noise during the training is a simple and natural way of biasing the network toward invariant representations. Now, I find this interesting because, as you'll see if you attend tomorrow's lecture, I'm interested in how mental representations are acquired from experience in development. And much of this involves bodily interaction with the world. And so things like the stabilization of representations are kind of interesting to me, definitely relevant to my research, but it's not always clear whether when people talk about representation in artificial intelligence or machine learning literature and computer science more generally, whether they're talking about the same thing that humans do. You know, there's this general issue of whether artificial intelligence really captures intelligence, whether it should be seen as overlapping with what human cognition does. And I think that question can be raised about representations. So here are the kind of questions that are in the background, some of them in the foreground, some of them throughout the talk. One is, what makes a mental representation a representation, as opposed to, for instance, a mere neurological state that affects downstream processing? Many people, I think, have a pretty clear idea of what certain kinds of representations are. A map, for example, seems like a good example of a representation. A map that, well, in the old days, one might unfold a physical map, a paper map. You might see a map on a map making program like Google Maps. It's available on the internet, things of that sort. And they depict what they represent. They provide a kind of picture of what they represent. Of course, pictures do the same thing, photographs. So that seems like a natural place to start when one is thinking about mental representation. But so much of the talk in cognitive science is about neurological states or motor representations. That's pretty far away from pictures or from maps. And so, you know, to what extent is the brain doing map making, or is there another kind of representation besides just map making? The other extant model of representations that are in our environment constantly is the linguistic model. Language provides a really straightforward example of something that we're inclined to think is representational. We use language to describe the world, and it must therefore be representing the world, you might think. And so one big question in cognitive science has been the extent to which theories of cognition should be modeled after external language. That's a kind of question that's in the background here today, and it will be tomorrow as well. And if the cognitive system is to be modeled after the linguistic system, or if it's going to be inspired by regular sort of spoken language or written language, what aspects of that comparison should be emphasized in the cognitive domain? Is it the, you know, syntactic structures, kind of Chomsky style approach, or would it be something that's oriented more toward general semantic content, like you might find in maps or you might find in bodily experience, and may have been emphasized in the cognitive linguistics literature. Another question is, what makes a representation particularly mental? What makes it a mental representation as opposed to some other kind of representation or something else altogether? There is, I think, a lot of danger to using language too heavily as our model for internal representation. It might be that the cognitive system is engaged in processes that are quite different from those that you see in a spoken language or a written language. Even though the language might itself reveal a lot about how the mind works. And we might ask also this question I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, what does a mental representation have in common with a representational data structure to which a machine learning algorithm is applied, that a machine learning algorithm creates? And the more general question here is about the relationship between mental representation in the human cognitive system and representations that appear in artificial intelligence. All right, so there have been some serious skeptical challenges issued. Recent work in philosophy of cognitive science has challenged prevailing notions of mental representation, either questioning the very existence of mental representations altogether or questioning the existence of non-pictorial mental representations. I think some of the skeptics are happy to find areas of the brain that are, say, topologically oriented, or I should say topographically oriented in some cases, that have a kind of, you know, a layout that preserves spatial relationships in the domain, say that's being sensed. You know, a visual domain provides kind of objects. One is to the left of another, which is to the right of another, you know, and you have a betweenness relationship. And that betweenness relationship in visual processing might be preserved in areas of visual cortex. And that many who are somewhat skeptical about mental representation seem happier with those kinds of cases. They're less happy with other kinds of mental representation, say those that may be more like an indicator light, a light in your car that says, ding, you're out of gas, or something like that. Your oil needs to be changed. It's just on or off. It kind of detects something in the environment. So there's a lot of skepticism about that kind of detection as a model for mental representation. Especially influential has been the idea that if something is a mental representation, it had better contribute to cognitive processing in virtue of its representational role. Sometimes the way this is put is that representations need a job description. They need to have a kind of description of what they do that kind of makes them representations. And this is the added part that if it causes some trouble, the skeptics think that representations need to contribute to cognitive processing in virtue of having that role, somehow in a way that deeply reflects that role. I'll return to many of these points as we move along. Here's a proposal. A physical structure is a mental representation functioning as such when the three following conditions are met. When it plays a substantive explanatory role in a mental architecture, the interaction of the various components of which accounts for the explananda of cognitive science, namely intelligent behavior, broadly construed. We comment on this condition. Part of the point here is that mental representations in and of themselves don't give rise to behavior. A mental representation contributes to the production of behavior, but it always does so within an architecture, within a framework of various kind of models, anything from, you know, operations like abstraction to kind of logical deduction operations, where one performs syllogisms or whatever, some way of processing the representations. Maybe it's by mere association, maybe by a whole lot of different operations. But again, the role of mental representations is to contribute within the context of an architecture. Now also, B, it differentially contributes to the production of behavior concerning the very property, individual, or kind that our naturalistic theory of content assigns as its content, as the representation's content. So the part of the representation's role is to produce behavior, as I said a moment ago, within the context of an architecture. Still, it is contributing to behavior. And we expect a representation relation, a theory of representational content, to assign content to a representation that is kind of appropriate to the behavior that representation produces. The representation should help to produce behavior directed toward the individual property or kind in question. And lastly, the structure should play a role in distinctively cognitive forms of processing. So I emphasize the role in architecture or being present in an architecture, but here I want to emphasize that the operations should be distinctively cognitive ones, such as backpropagation of error or the formation of a single production rule as a result of past uses of the same chain of production rules to solve similar problems. These are two examples chosen somewhat at random from the history of cognitive science. I'm not proposing that either one of these is necessarily central to human cognition, but the idea is that cognitive science is a distinct discipline. It's appealing to and deploying resources that are unique to or specific to cognition. There are many cellular processes that are happening throughout the body that may be necessary for cognition, but they aren't specific to cognition. And so those cellular processes wouldn't be part of a cognitive scientific explanation or distinctively cognitive scientific explanation. So distinctively cognitive forms of processing are the ones that play a significant role in cognitive scientific modeling, but not in other sciences. My example of cellular processing, the other science would be biology. In that case, the cellular processes don't really play a significant role in cognitive scientific modeling at all. Okay, let me comment a bit on A and B. Beyond the comments that I've provided already, one question that's been frequently asked is how a representation might play a substantive explanatory role. Can representations earn their explanatory keep, as sometimes it is put? Now, it's partly a matter, from my standpoint, this is partly a matter of the representation itself, the role of the representation itself, individuated physically or computationally, the vehicle, as it's sometimes called, to strip away the semantic content or representational content. So it's partly a matter of the representation itself contributing to processing. The operations referred to in C involve the causing of changes in the causal role of such physical structures. In learning, for example, I mentioned a backpropagation algorithm. This is an algorithm used in connectionist modeling that's meant to improve the system's performance in response to error. So it involves a kind of learning and adjustment of relationships between the artificial neurons in an artificial neural network or a connectionist network. So the, whatever these vehicles are, whether they're nodes in a connectionist network or something entirely different, the vehicles of mental representation must be causal participants in these processes that are distinctive of cognitive science. And it's also a matter of the correlation between, one, the holding of the representation relation, the extent of its holding, and two, variance in behavioral data involving interaction with the thing represented. So I see maybe the heading on the last slide might have been comments on C more, but here we really have moved on to comments on A and B. We want to know how the representation relation helps to kind of explain something, or at least one kind of explanation is accounting for variance in behavioral data, differences in behavior depending on differences in stimuli or conditions, typically experimental conditions. Moreover, as with any quantity invoked in a model, it should play a robust role. The holding of the representation fixing facts should account for such variance across a wide range of relevant sets of data and tasks. If our theory of content assigns a representational value to a given unit, we want that representational value to sort of be relevant to the way that unit contributes across a wide range of cases. Otherwise, it seems kind of ad hoc if it only is relevant in one behavioral instance or one kind of behavioral instance. If I have a mental representation of the ocean, I want that representation to come into play or to be able to contribute to a wide range of forms of kind of ocean-directed behavior, whether it's fishing or boating or swimming. Let me go through a fairly simple example to illustrate what I've been saying. This has all been at a fairly abstract level, so let's look at the very concrete, everyday kind of example. Imagine that I'm introduced to John, someone I've never met before. A week later, I see him while walking in a shopping mall, and I wave to him as I pass. I passed hundreds of people in the crowd at the mall, and he is the only one I waved to that day. I also said, "Hi, John," yelled to him across the mall. These are statistically improbable actions, deviations from the null hypothesis. Why should there be any waving taking place at all at that moment? Waving has a relatively low base rate. It's not a behavior I engage in very often. What makes this all even more improbable is the relation between the object of the action and the object of my previous interaction. It's the same person, it's John. Now, why should there be this kind of correlation between my having met John and then a week later, my greeting John? A simple naturalistic theory of content might posit that a representation relationship was established when I met John. and that would help to explain the correlation between my meeting John and my later greeting behavior. The idea is that a simple theory of representational content might run as follows, right? I mean, imagine a simple theory of representational content according to which the representational content of a newly formed unit is whatever was the primary cause of the vehicle's initial formation. In the example, John was the primary cause of the formation of that new unit. At a later date, that vehicle causes an otherwise statistically improbable action directed toward the proposed content of the unit. So that's a way in which this kind of representation relation, this posited representation relation, can then, in a kind of statistical sense, account for variance in later behavior. It does some work in a model of that behavior, where a model here will be cashed out statistically. The idea is that the past hypothesis that the hypothesis that the past interaction established a representation relation helps to account for the variance in behavior. Prior to meeting John, I walked past him many times. Maybe I live in a fairly small town. I walked past him many times, but never waved or said hello. That difference in behavior is partly accounted for by the difference in representational facts. There's a new representational fact after I met him. Now that I have a mental representation of John, I'm more likely to engage in certain forms of behavior directed toward him. Now, of course, more might be said about the form of that representation. Is it an atomic unit, a simple structure like this kind of dummy light or the detector light that one sees on the dashboard of one's car that provides a warning that something's gone wrong? You're out of gas or your oil needs to be changed, things of that sort. So my representation of John could be like that, or it could be more complex. It could involve, say, an obvious thing that would be involved is an association between the sound pattern, John, his name, and the, say, mental representation of his facial features. So maybe something more like a knowledge structure with a cluster of different related representations as part of it. I'm most interested in development and the way these vehicles form initially. You know, one interesting question is when you meet John here, let's say, where does the new representation come from? In many cases, a representation may appear, say, in development as a result of bodily interaction with the environment. And so I will talk a bit more tomorrow about how mental representations can emerge from this kind of embodied interaction. And I think there's a deep connection between how a mental representation as a non-semantic unit gets formed and the content that that representation takes. But I don't have this simple theory of representation where it's just, you know, the item that was present on the initial formation of the unit is the item that's referred to, or the kind or the property that's referred to. I think the process of taking on representational content is more gradual, and I'll try to make that clear tomorrow how that works. Okay, continuing a bit with the example and what it's meant to illustrate. Moreover, treating the initial interaction as representation fixing is moderately predictive of a wide range of actions that deviate from the null hypothesis, all the sorts of ways I might interact with John. This gives the initially established relation an important role to play in accounting for my behavior relative to John. Now add the fact that those forms of behavior are in the domain of cognitive science, and also that processes to which the vehicle in question contributes are those distinctive of cognitive scientific modeling. And we can treat this, on my view, as a potentially explanatory representation relation. As I indicated a moment ago, I think the actual representation relation will be more complex. It will involve more gradual processes, and in many cases, especially in the development case. But you know, this is a nice simple start, just the idea that upon the first interaction with something, a new vehicle is formed or introduced by the cognitive system. and that vehicle gets tacked on to the individual or kind or property that's being first met, first encountered. All right, so some of my comments just indicated that there are different possible representation relations, and this is a matter of some concern, I guess, in the sense that it may be hard to identify the correct one, but it shouldn't be a surprise that there are lots of options available to us when we're trying to model some behavior and we're introducing a quantity. So the representation relation, representation fixing or establishing relation just appealed to is very simple. Vehicle R has object O as its content if and only if O was the primary cause of the formation of R. Now, as I said, in tomorrow's lecture, I'll introduce a more complex relation. Which characterization of the representation relation is the correct one depends on which yields the most statistical power when attempting to model human behavior. So this is a matter of really emphasizing the methodological naturalism that in cognitive science, what we should be doing is trying to model data. And typically that involves statistical modeling. There are other forms of modeling as well that might involve positing an architecture that engages in logical derivation, which may itself not be statistical nature, although still the positing of that architecture and the confirming of its operation in response to data will itself involve some statistical reasoning about how to best explain that data. Now, one thing to consider, which muddies the waters and makes the discussion more complicated, is that there might be different representation relations for different kinds of mental representations, say perceptual versus linguistic. And note too that the utility of a given representation relation depends on the architecture in which it's set. Point that I emphasized earlier, no representation alone generates behavior. It does so only within an architecture or model containing other elements. I won't go through examples, but this is a kind of difficulty that arises somewhat frequently in the philosophical literature on mental representation. I'll say, well, if I had a representation of such and such, then I should do X. And we have to kind of step back and say, well, no, it depends on, you know, what else is in your mind. You may have a representation that there's a cookie in front of you, but if you don't also want a cookie, if you're not hungry, then you may not eat the cookie. So, or if you are hungry, but you have a desire to lose weight, to stay on your diet, then you might not eat the cookie. And so the whole, that's a kind of simple everyday explanation of how it takes more than one element to cause behavior. Typically, there's a collaboration of forces. But the architectural framework is important as well. How representation are stored, how they're accessed, how they become active, how likely they are to contribute in a given situation, given how active they are or not. So all of these parameters will have to be fixed as well when giving an explanation of behavior or a set of data, behavioral data. Am I talking about representation in general? Well, I don't mean to be. What I've offered is not a recipe for representation in general or an analysis of the concept of representation. It is meant as a theoretical account of successful practice in cognitive science that makes use of mental or cognitive representations. For example, some of the work I cited at the beginning of the talk, perhaps particularly in cognitive neuroscience, but also say in the child's acquisition of language, be a case where this is relevant. There may or may not be other kinds of representation, and going beyond the cognitive case or the human thought. That is, representations that are not mental or cognitive representations and do not inherit their content from mental or cognitive representations. I don't want to take a stand on this issue. I'm not going to press a view one way or the other. It's not clear to me that the generic notion of a representation is usefully treated as a natural or scientific kind, property, or relation. That is, often kinds that are common sense kinds that seem apparent to us when we introspect a kind like pain or memory seems like a legitimate kind, but upon investigation, scientific investigation, it splits into lots of different subkinds to the point where the overarching kind doesn't seem to do much work anymore. And maybe the notion of representation is like that. Maybe there are simply depictive representations and cognitive representations. You know, there are paintings and they represent one way, and there's mental operations and they represent another way, as we would normally speak. But they really aren't two different ways of doing the same thing. The overarching concept of representation isn't, it's too thin to be useful. The scientific explanation will always appeal to the more detailed facts about that particular case, what I'd be calling a kind of representation, perhaps misleadingly. I don't want to take a stand on this issue. I'm not trying to tell you what representation is in general. I have a very specific target in mind. What is cognitive content, mental content? What are mental representations? That cluster of ideas is the relevant cluster. It's about human cognition. All right, I'm going to move on and talk about some of the, and spend most of the rest of the lecture talking about some skepticism concerning mental representation. And I want to be sure that we have some naturalistic principles in the background. I think some of this may sound a bit redundant, but I'll go through it quickly. I have three principles in mind. One is an emphasis on theoretical posits and causal explanatory power. The measure of a naturalistic theory of representational content is its contribution to successful modeling in cognitive science. Not that it measures what we kind of pre-theoretically think should be assigned as the content of a mental representation. This is going to come up in a few minutes in connection with one of the skeptics. Often skeptics will say things like, well, your theory of representation says I'm representing, you know, X, I'm representing a strong change in the intensity of the light gradient hitting my retina. And the person will say, but that doesn't seem like what I'm representing. So your theory is wrong. But, you know, that's not really a methodological naturalist approach. And so I'm going to set that aside. We should ask of a posited representation relation whether it plays a significant role in causal explanatory models to be evaluated by the normal standards of scientific theorizing. And secondly, something I haven't talked about before is that we want to keep in mind the relational nature of the explananda in cognitive science. Cognitive scientific data are largely relational. They pertain to subjects' interaction with the environment, reading text, responding to images on a screen, writing essays, working physics problems on an exam, engaging in conversation, driving a car, creating sculptures, and so on. This all involves responses to items in the environment, creation of items in the environment, interaction with things beyond the skin. Often, cognitive scientists, philosophers of cognitive science have talked as if one can consider only what's happening beneath the skin, but that doesn't jibe very well with the kind of data that's collected in the experimental sciences that's supposed to be providing cognitive science with its data. Those data involve interactive experiments, say responding to images on a screen, indicating whether one comprehends a sentence or, you know, believes that a sentence is well-formed or not well-formed. So this is, you may see the relevance of this is that when I worked through the example earlier and I talked about meeting John, I talked about that initial interaction as relational, as involving my interactions with John. And then the data later on were relational as well. I waved to John. I said hello, you know, with my face and eyes oriented toward John. And so the coding of the data is relational. It's not surprising then that a relational fact would help to explain that. The fact that I interacted with John and met him is a relational fact. The coding of the data, waving to John, is relational. It's about a relation between John and me. So this makes it seem less mysterious, maybe, that representational facts could play an explanatory role. Thirdly, I will make the natural kinds only assumption. This will be more important in tomorrow's lecture, but it will come up once or twice in what remains. The idea is that, you know, we begin with a kind of question: what materials might a naturalist draw upon when trying to fit representation into the non-mental causal order of nature? The answer here is that kinds are properties already sufficiently vindicated by successful non-intentional sciences. This is how the reduction of, say, chemistry to physics proceeds, or how the explanation of biological phenomena and chemical terms goes. It seems to be a standard way to explain why there are facts of a certain sort in terms of facts that are thought to be more fundamental. So behind this is the thought that mentality is not fundamental. So I preached or promoted the idea of methodological naturalism in my opening remarks. And part of those remarks indicated that I, as a methodological naturalist, would want to follow scientific methods wherever they lead. But many philosophers of cognitive science, self included, have thought that, well, there's only so far we'd want to take that. One thing that if you're going to have some kind of basic level commitment to naturalism, you might want to stay away from the animation of nature, of putting minds into nature. Electrons don't have minds. Electrons don't have desires or hopes or fears. Compound chemicals don't have minds. Well, compound substances don't have minds or desires or hopes or fears. Mind is something that arises in nature, you might think evolutionarily. It arises out of processes that were non-minded, did not have minds. And so this has been kind of taken to be the goal in much of the naturalization of mental content or representational content, is to try to find a place for this content relation or representation relation in the physical relations that are recognized by other sciences. So kinds from cognitive neuroscience might be especially relevant because, you know, we think the brain plays an especially important role in producing behavior. So, you know, there will be natural sciences to look to. That is natural choices of a science as opposed to some other science. We should be open-minded here to a variety of sciences that might contribute to these explanations, in particular when we're thinking about what kinds of properties might be detected or tracked or indicated and thus represented. We want to, you know, limit ourselves to properties that are recognized by successful sciences. Not properties that are essentially mental or intentional is the term that's sometimes used. I'll talk more about that term tomorrow. All right, so I'm going to move now to the work of Frances Egan. You may come across her references to her as Frankie Egan. She has a skeptical view, which I'll say is largely inspired by Chomsky's work in linguistics. And Egan makes this very clear. She's impressed by this idea of a formal system, as Chomsky has sometimes treated the generative grammar that maybe many of you are familiar with really an emphasis on the syntactic properties and the stepwise application of rules on the basis of syntactic properties to generate well-formed sentences or to process incoming sentences. And disambiguate them and then perhaps assign meaning. But much of the Chomskyan program puts meaning on the sideline. It tends to put semantic content on the sidelines. And Egan generalizes this idea, thinking about cognitive science as essentially computational in nature. Computations, she insists, run over uninterpreted symbols. With the possible exception of mathematical content, computation is insensitive to semantic or representational meaning. Again, content. I say with the possible exception of mathematical content, because you might think that computation is essentially a mapping from one domain to another, a domain to a codomain. The computation of squaring maps a number to its square. It maps 4 to 16 and 5 to 25, right? 4 squared is 16, 5 squared is 25, so on. So there's a kind of mapping relation that's presupposed by computation itself. So there might be a representation of mathematical content. But other than that, Egan says, talk about representations, kind of representation of features in our environment or kinds or properties in our environment. This is misguided if one is being serious about cognitive science. She says, representational content, as we normally conceive of it, has no role to play in a fully serious cognitive science, although it can be pragmatically useful to assign content in many circumstances. She does kind of admit that and talk about some of the circumstances in which it's pragmatically useful. So one kind of example she uses kind of after discussing, you know, the Chomskyan picture of linguistic processing, she extends this to visual mechanisms. And she says, consider a computational mechanism that on Earth reliably tracks edges by computing sharp changes in local light intensities on the retina. So this is drawn from a classic work in vision science by David Marr and his colleagues. There's a book by Marr from 1982 called Vision, where this process of tracking sharp changes in local light intensities is one of the fundamental operations taking place early in visual processing. And it helps identify the boundaries of the boundary of a table, the boundary of a book, and so on. But Egan says, in some other possible world with a different physical environment or different laws of physics, the same computational mechanism might reliably track something different. Maybe the outlines of shadows, the boundaries of shadows, where there isn't a physical edge. Shadows don't have physical edges. She says, more generally, only in some environments would computing the Laplacian of a Gaussian help the organism to see. So that's the mathematical formalism that is involved in early visual processing, according to Marr. We don't need to go into those details. But the point, I included the quote just to emphasize the environment relativity of kind of how we think about the way the mechanism works and contributes to behavior may depend on the environment. But Egan's intuition is that it's the same mechanism across cases. So when we talk about its representational content relative to a given environment, that's a mere gloss, Egan says. It's a gloss we attach to the computational formalism to describe the mechanism as it's possessed by a human on Earth. In that situation, we describe it as an edge detector, or say that the structures that algorithm creates represent edges. But that is not, strictly speaking, true. Strictly speaking, we should be thinking only about the syntactic properties or formal properties of the data structures that the computation is operating on. So I'll respond to Egan in a way that rests on principles one and two, although I won't say, you know, too much about the contact between them, but you should see the connection. Earthly possessors of this mechanism interact in regular ways with objects that have edges. Humans slice food using kitchen knives. Knives have edges. Humans pick up books by their edges, and so on. Those are the data. That's part of what we want to explain. So if we assume that the composite model of all this data includes a content-determining relation between some of the structures that the visual mechanism operates on and edges, and that those structures consistently contribute to the modeling of edge-directed behavior. In that case, a theory of representation has a role to play in cognitive science. This is how modeling typically works. One varies one statistical quantity and then sees whether variation in that quantity accounts for variation in something else, like a behavioral quantity, different codings of the behavior. Now, Egan considers this possibility, but she's concerned about these hypothetical cases or other possible worlds. She's motivated by like far-fetched cases in which the mechanism in question plays a different role, like the one in which she claims that the mechanism might detect the boundary of shadows rather than edges. Now, I would be concerned about this mere possibility. It's really purely hypothetical. It's incumbent on Egan to show that naturalistic methodology should be sensitive to those imaginary cases. You know, we don't normally look at a scientific theory and say, well, you've explained the data pretty well, but what if someday we collected data of a different sort? I think most natural scientists, social scientists modeling data, they would shrug their shoulders and say, well, it's not our responsibility to explain data of that hasn't been collected yet or seems deeply at odds with the data that we've collected. You know, humans do see shadows and they do use mechanisms for detecting shadows, but we're talking about a case in which humans don't use this mechanism for detecting the boundary of shadows. Maybe it's possible for creatures like us to, you know, function differently in a different environment, but without that data, there's not really a responsibility for our cognitive science to accommodate it. Moreover, even if there is in fact a world in which the same visual mechanism is used by organisms to track the boundaries of shadows, a number of representationalist responses are available. I won't go through them all, but I'll give you some idea what a representationalist like myself might say. Presumably, edges of objects and boundaries of shadows have something in common, a change in the intensity of light, perhaps. And there must be some reason why, you know, this mechanism can do two different things. If just pretending for a minute it can, if it does do two different things in two different environments, there must be something it's picking up on in those two cases, you might think. Presumably then humans in the two different worlds detect a change in the intensity of light, and the detector in question contributes to the construction of a downstream representation of the edge of a table or the shape of a shadow, depending on which of these two hypothetical worlds, the actual one or the hypothetical one, the subjects are in. Now, it might be that behavior in such a situation is more coarse-grained than the property detected. And so the detector shouldn't be seen as a representation at all. You know, there are further details to be filled in. We want to be sure that if we're assigning representational content, that content does play some kind of role in differentially affecting behavior. But really, the point I've made already is the operative one. Egan's concern gets traction, however, only if such empirical details become available. What Egan owes us is a genuine case in which a common property is detected across cases and is one that human behavior is not differentially directed toward. Her response, I should say, Egan does briefly comment on a case like this, and her response is to say, well, representation of a sudden change in the intensity of light, that's not the kind of thing we'd normally think of as being represented. That doesn't sound like the sort of representational content that philosophers have in mind. But I think my response is, you know, so what? There are a lot of things in nature that science has revealed that weren't the sorts of things we had in mind in advance. So the theory of relativity is a very strange idea that there's no plane of absolute simultaneity. And special relativity, that sounds really odd. But the oddness of the sound is not a reason to reject it if it's otherwise useful. If we were to have this data, if the hypothetical world were to become real, sounds very far-fetched, but if we were to find another world like Egan describes, then we would just need to do our best science. And it might turn out that there is a common element detected across these cases, a common feature in the environment that shadows share with edges, and that our behavior can be modeled as responsive to that element. That might be the way things turn out, even if it sounds strange in advance. All right. Well, let's turn now to the skepticism of Bill Ramsey. Ramsey is especially critical of the idea of detectors as representations. These indicator lights, I've been using the comparison to lights that come on a dashboard of a vehicle. Detectors are often thought of as representations, but they don't, according to Ramsey, function as representations. They're more like mere causal mediators or relay switches. He uses the example of a trigger on a gun at one point. It's just a relay. It's just a kind of link in a causal chain and a series of mechanistic interactions. So while cognitive scientists might assume some structure is a representation and then describe the interesting mediating role it plays, that wouldn't tell us why it counts as a representation in the first place, according to Ramsey. After all, he says, causal mediation is everywhere. So, you know, if this is just a kind of causal mediation, then there's nothing kind of representationally special about it. We're looking, Ramsey says, for cases where causal mediators play the role of representations as such, in virtue of being representations. Now, I think there might be a problem of mere causal mediation, but it's not the one Ramsey has in mind. Ramsey is right that causal mediation is everywhere. It may well be that that is all the universe ultimately consists of. You might think that, you know, that's what a naturalism is committed to, that in the end, particularly a kind of physicalism, in the end, all there is fundamental physics. They're just one quantity, charge, for example, interacting with other quantities. And that's a kind of, maybe it's a bleak view of the universe, but it's a common metaphysics, common enough. So it's physics as the ultimate story, comprehensive story about the entire universe. And in that case, all there is in the universe is causal mediation. So if there are going to be other sciences, Ramsey's running into trouble because he runs the risk of proving too much, that no properties or kinds exist other than those related by cause and effect in fundamental physics. After all, if you're going to get rid of mental representations because they're mere causal mediators, then you should get rid of the concept of a noble gas or the concept of an organic molecule or any old concept from the other sciences, because they all are a way of describing mere causal mediation. The thing to keep in mind is that naturalistic semanticists propose to identify a particular pattern of causal relations that is useful in modeling. This causal relation might be fairly complex, just as other properties in the sciences are. So think of properties of the immune system, such as being a T cell. It's a kind of white blood cell that helps, you know, keep us healthy by killing pathogens. And that killing of pathogens by our immune system is mere causal processes, one after another. But it's a particularly kind of complicated pattern in which very, you know, specific kinds of cells participate in a specific kind of process. And so it's worth carving out that pattern and giving it a specific name and looking at it as a kind of unique or distinctive process that helps to explain other processes that we're interested in or outcomes that we're interested in, like remaining healthy or getting sick. So the point about mere causal mediation really isn't an effective criticism of detector style representations that simply light up on or off to detect some property in the environment. So long as they're, what makes them representations is a kind of more complicated pattern of contribution, and we'll talk more about this shortly, then we might have latched on to some interesting kind, like the kind T cell, even if ultimately it's just a matter of causal mediation, because, you know, everything is. So Fred Dretske raises the puzzle here and then offers a solution. And I think this will help us see where Ramsey has gone wrong. Dretske is trying to build a naturalistic theory of mental content, representational content, out of the tools of probability theory. He thinks the universe is made up of events. These events can be related probabilistically. That's a natural part of the order of nature. And so here's a kind of tool we can take from nature to try to characterize mental content in a way that's kind of naturalistically legitimate materialistically legitimate. So Tretzky says, by definition, A indicates B if and only if the obtaining of A is such that probability of B given A equals one, given channel conditions and for law-based reasons. I just put that in to be accurate and faithful to Tretzky, but it's not going to be of much importance, channel conditions and law-based reasons. Just doesn't want it to be an accident that this probabilistic relation holds. But the what I've represented here is what's sometimes called the conditional probability, the probability of that first event B happening, given that the following event A happens, following in that order reading left to right. So sometimes the probability that a given event occurs, a given kind is present, given that another event has occurred, equals one. Often dice rolling is given, used to illustrate concepts for probability theory. What's the probability that an even number has been rolled on the die, given that the number four has been rolled on the die? Well, that probability is one. The probability of evenness given fourness is one. It's guaranteed that you rolled an even number once you've rolled a four. It just follows by, in that case, by definition. Dretzky's more interested in natural processes than kind of mathematical facts. So it's not the best illustration, but it shows you how a conditional probability could be one. Now, what Dretzky observes is that in many cases in which we intuitively think that A represents B, this cognitive structure represents, you know, horses in the environment, the probability of B given A, the probability that there's a horse in the environment given the activation of this mental structure, is less than one. A's obtaining is consistent with what we would normally treat as its misrepresentation of, say, something else, C, like a cow, right? As a horse. So our just intuition going into the case, you know, maybe it needs to be adjusted, but we enter the situation thinking, here's a cognitive structure. We think that refers to horses, but the probability of there being a horse present, given that the structure has become active, is less than one. Sometimes the structure is caused to become active by something else, say a cow. So the probability is, maybe we only get a probability of one when we create a disjunction, a B or C. So in some such cases, the probability of B or C, given A equals one. Maybe we have a mental structure that can only be caused by cows or horses. So the probability that either there's a cow present or a horse present, given that that mental structure has become active, equals one. We might think though that even in that situation, A represents only B, but by Dretzky's definition, it indicates, or also he says, carries information that B or C. Okay, so this is the puzzle. How would we get representation from indication or information carrying? Dretzky's solution is that in any individual case of A's activation, either an instance of B or C is present. In my simple example, in real life cognitive structures, there may be a whole host of things that could cause an individual structure to be activated. But we don't want to have to wade through a whole host of examples. We'll just limit it to B or C. There are two things in my toy example, a cow or a horse. A is, we think, reference to horses. It represents horses. Mostly it's caused by bees, but occasionally a cow on a dark night from the distance, whatever, cause A's to be activated in the cognitive system. So, but notice though, in any individual case of A's activation, either an instance of B or an instance of C is present. One of those two things will be present if the formula at the bottom of the previous slide is correct. Because look again at that formula, the probability of either B or C being present given A equals one, maximal probability. So there has to be one or the other present if A becomes active. So in any individual case of A's activation, one of the two, a horse or a cow, will be there. But if that activation of A, the mental structure, causes a reinforced action, it will be an objective matter which of the two, B or C, is responsible for that instance of reinforcement. If there's a systematic difference between the two cases, over a range of cases, that's what makes it systematic, A represents the property or kind of the two that is differentially responsible for reinforcement. If what you're doing is riding horses, and occasionally you mistake a cow for a horse and put a saddle on the cow and try to jump on the cow, well, you might have pretty bad luck, might have a pretty bad experience. So the cases where activating your horse representation leads to behavior that gets reinforced will be the cases when the horses were present, not the cases when the cows were present. So it's the present, the presence of horses that reinforces the use of A in the system to control further behavior. And Dretske says this provides an objective fact that winnows down the meaning to only, you know, some of its possible causes. Dretske doesn't particularly like to talk in terms of causes, but for our purposes, that's close enough. So this gives Dretske grounds for saying that was one aspect of the information carried rather than the other that A represents, that B rather than A, it was horses rather than cows, and allows him to say that it is because of A's correlation with, say, B rather than C, that A causes in general and in combination with the motivational state and in the context of the architecture, the sort of action that was reinforced. It's that there's this kind of relevance of the past relational fact that B was the thing present when A became activated and produced behavior that was reinforced. That relational fact now helps to explain why in the future A engages in B-directed behavior of a certain sort, just a particular kind of behavior, the one that was reinforced. So in a nutshell, of the possible causes of a given mental structure, the content of that structure is the possible cause in the environment that has reinforcing power. In this way, you might think the content of A doesn't directly cause the behavior. It's not there inside the brain activating a motor routine, but it is because A has the content it has that A helps to cause that sort of behavior at all. And to be sympathetic to Egan, I think part of what bothers her and what has bothered a number of skeptics about mental representation is that if mental representation is going to be what's sometimes called externalist, if it's going to consist in a relation to something else, it points to the thing that the representation is about. If it's going to be externally or relationally directed, then there's a question about how that external relation could contribute to processing or bring about our behavior, because you know that the thing that's been related to, if I'm thinking about the World Series or the ocean or the Eiffel Tower, the ocean or the Eiffel Tower, they're not in my head there to cause my action. So how can that relation make a difference? So much of Dretske's project was to explain how that relation makes a difference. And my proposal early in today's talk is a kind of generalization of some of the things Dretske says, one that's sensitive to a broader range of work in cognitive science and is not focused very narrowly on this idea of perfect information, conditional probabilities of one, reinforcement learning alone, there are all kinds of other operations besides reinforcement learning, I think. But Dretske limits himself to reinforcement learning. Now, I want to respond to this problem that Ramsey emphasizes, what he sometimes calls the as such problem, this idea that representations, if they're going to be mental representations, they better contribute as such, as mental representations. I have a hard time parsing this demand, and I'll try to explain why. Ramsey and other skeptics claim that if something is to be a representation, it must contribute to cognitive processing or the production of behavior in virtue of its being a representation, in virtue of its fulfilling the job description of representations. But I think this demand is wrong-headed. It's based on a kind of mistaken understanding of how kinds, why things fall under the kinds that they do. Consider acids in the chemical sense. Right? A substance is an acid if and only if it's a proton donor. It's the simple definition of an acid, is likely to lose protons in certain kinds of chemical interactions. So a substance is an acid in virtue of being a proton donor, in virtue of doing something in chemical interactions. But it doesn't contribute to chemical interactions in virtue of the property that qualifies it as an acid. That would lead to a kind of ridiculous result. If that were the case, it would be contributing protons in virtue of being a thing that contributes protons, right? Because why is it an acid? Being an acid is being a thing that contributes protons. If it's supposed to do what it does in chemical interactions in virtue of it being an acid, then it would have to do its thing, contributing protons, in virtue of being a thing that contributes protons, which is shows that something has gone badly wrong here. And it's similar with mental representations. They are representations in virtue of what they do, the kinds of things that I described early on in the talk, what they do, the way they participate in the functioning of operations that are distinctive to cognitive science, the way they contribute to behavior that's directed toward the very kind of thing that they represent, or that the proposed representation relation says they represent. So, you know, there are these things that representations do that qualify them as representations, but they don't do what they do in virtue of their role in cognitive science and cognitive processing. In that case, they would be doing what they do in virtue of what they do. That is, they do some things in cognitive processing, and because they do those things, they qualify as representations. But if they were doing what they do in virtue of their role as mental representations, then they would be doing what they do in virtue of doing what they do. This is a bit hard to follow. So think about a related problem that's been raised. It's sometimes called the virtus dormitiva problem, based on a play by a French playwright, Molière. And in the scene from this play, a doctor gives a potion to a patient and tells him that it will put him to sleep. And the patient says, "Why will it put me to sleep?" And the doctor says, "Because it has a dormitive virtue." But what is a dormitive virtue? It's the power to put something to sleep. So the doctor seems to be saying, this thing will put you to sleep because it has the power to put you to sleep, which really isn't very helpful. So we don't want a demand of mental representations that they do what they do in virtue of being mental representations. No, we want to figure out what they do in cognitive processing. And if they do something kind of distinctive or interesting, we can label that a representational role. We have to get the cart before the horse there. All right, one last kind of problem that's been raised, and I can't go through all the details here. Dan Hutto and Eric Mayen have spent much of the last decade railing against content in cognitive science, as maybe as it appears, especially in models, including subpersonal cognitive units, but really generally the way cognitive scientists talk about mental representation, they oppose. And I won't be able to go through all this, but I'll talk about a fragment of their concern. So genuine content requires that the vehicle in question express a proposition. They think this is a truth about representation. And thus it must have accuracy conditions, be truth-bearing, and exhibit intentional phenomena, above other things. But these are three of the things they identify. Units that carry information about, co-vary with, or reliably caused by their targets don't have these properties. If you think about an indicator light that says your gasoline, petrol is low in your vehicle, that might have accuracy conditions, but it's not truth-bearing and it doesn't exhibit intentional phenomena. I'll say more about what that means just in a second. So there is no information-based content or covariation-based content, content of the indicator light or detector unit style, because those they're just not sophisticated enough, according to Hutto and Mayen. But one might ask why mental representations should have all those properties. So here the methodological naturalism is coming out again. Insisting on conceptual grounds that they must have all these properties seems to flout naturalistic principle one. Rather, we should want to know what these properties explain, and whether they're necessary for such explanations. One of the principles that drives much scientific thinking is to do as much as you can with as little as you can. It's a sometimes called Occam's razor sort of idea that one shouldn't multiply entities or forces or other elements of your model beyond necessity. So it might seem to Hutto and Mayan that representations will have all of these properties that involve expressing propositions, and they're essentially normative, and they exhibit intentional phenomena in and of themselves. And but if you can account for the phenomena, the actual measurable or behavioral phenomena, with a simpler set of resources, that's a win. That is success scientifically. And some of those resources might look very much like representations, even if they don't match exactly what Hutto and Mayan had in mind going in. Now, to some extent, this leads to a disagreement about the use of the term representation, and I want to be honest about that. There is a kind of general problem in philosophy of science identifying the continuity of the use of a word over time, the use of a theoretical term over time. Many theoretical terms in the sciences kind of change their meaning or change their designation or change what they represent over time. And the question might arise, like, when is that acceptable? And when has the subject just been changed? I think that's what Hutto and Mayer are inclined to say about much of naturalistic semantics, is that folks like me have just changed the subject. But we want to be tolerant of the fact that throughout the sciences, the history of the sciences, terms have often kind of changed their meaning, have been applied to a slightly different range of objects. Acid, the example I used earlier from chemistry, is an example of this. A number of different definitions of acid were entertained at the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s. So, it's hard to tell in advance what's required in order to, to continue talking about the same subject, to not be changing the subject and kind of just misusing a term. An important step in resolving this disagreement is to identify plausible explanations of the phenomena themselves. I'll turn to this. But as a preliminary remark, I want to say something about a Fodorian framework, framework offered by Jerry Fodor, now deceased, but prominent philosopher of cognitive science. According to Jerry Fodor, a belief state is individuated by its externalist content, a kind of representational or relational content that I've been talking about, by relation to the thing that's represented or the property that's represented or the kind that's represented beyond the vehicle itself. Belief state is individuated by that externalist content and the vehicles that carry the content of the belief state. Can this framework, making use only of vehicles, externalist content, as well as architectural operations, because Fodor is operating within a computationalist architecture, can this account for the relevant observable phenomena? In what follows, I focus specifically on intention-related phenomena. So there is this phenomenon of intentionality that philosophers of language and some linguists have noted. It's described in very general terms. It's that certain sentences are resistant to the substitution of co-referential terms. One might believe that Clark Kent works for a newspaper without believing that Superman works for a newspaper. So in the comic books, Superman, the superhero, is when he's not dressed up as a superhero, is a character named Clark Kent, a person named Clark Kent, who works at a newspaper. And so someone in that fiction, someone in the world of Superman, doesn't know that Clark Kent and Superman are the same person. Clark Kent is Superman's alter ego, as it's sometimes put. And so this person might think, yes, Clark Kent works for the newspaper. I believe that Clark Kent works for the newspaper, but doesn't believe that Superman works for the newspaper. So the sentence, say, Joe believes that Clark Kent works for the newspaper, may be true, but the substitution of a co-referring term, Superman, which refers to the very same entity as Clark Kent, does not is not allowed. It doesn't preserve the truth of the belief attribution. When I say Joe believes that Superman works for the newspaper, I have changed the sentence from true to false. Joe doesn't believe that. So the verb believes that is sometimes said to create an intentional context with an S in intention. So subjects exhibit various forms of behavior that do not seem explicable by representational or externalist content alone. I've changed now from attributing beliefs to individuals to talking about their behavior, which I think is more relevant to cognitive science. That content is a matter of being related to an individual kind or property, that representational or externalist content alone. In many cases, an individual has two representations with the same content of this externalist sort, but does not realize it. And the individual's behavior does not reflect that sameness of content. Venus, the planet, for example, might be represented as phosphorus in medieval Europe, also known as the morning star, or as Hesperus, also known as the evening star, because of the time, during at different times in the month or in the broader cycle of planetary movements, at different times Venus is brightly on the horizon in the morning or brightly on the horizon in the evening, because it appeared brightly in these two different places at different times. Medieval Europeans thought that they were two different bodies, right? But it was really, astronomers found out later, one and the same body the whole time. It was just Venus. So there were these two different pairs of co-referential terms. Phosphorus refers to Venus, Hesperus refers to Venus. The morning star refers to Venus, the evening star refers to Venus. The subject might exhibit behavior that's inexplicable when one considers representational content only. If Venus is the same thing as Hesperus, phosphorus is the same thing as Hesperus, as the planet Venus, and the subject is asked whether he would like to view Hesperus tomorrow morning, he might say, "That's impossible, but I'd love to go with you to see phosphorus," because he doesn't realize that Hesperus and phosphorus are the same thing. He responds to the question in a Hesperus-specific way. But it seems like his behavior, his linguistic behavior, his utterance is kind of inexplicable. If content alone were relevant, he'd be contradicting himself. He'd be saying, you can't see Hesperus in the morning, but you can see one and the same thing, phosphorus, in the morning. So if he understood what his terms referred to, he wouldn't be exhibiting this behavior. So just in terms of the content considered alone, he seems to be contradicting himself. The content seems to predict two different behaviors, and things become a mess. The externalist content of our subject's behavior, the externalist contents of our subject's beliefs, I should say, do not explain the behavior in question. They seem to entail a contradiction that our subject both believes that Venus will be out in the morning and that it's impossible for Venus to be out in the morning. Well, which is it? Very strange. It leads to these two different behaviors. Note, however, that facts about causal relations that vehicles enter into must be included in our models. Part of a model of a cognitive architecture and cognitive processing will include the vehicles themselves that enter into relations that determine representational content. But those vehicles will also play a role in processing, and whatever it is, the application of production rules or the application of back propagation or reinforcement learning or what have you, any of these operations distinctive of cognitive science. So these are the causal roles of these vehicles have to be included in our models. And that the two vehicles that produce verbal outputs, Hesperus and phosphorus respectively, differ in the various relations they enter into in the cognitive system. You know, relations to, for example, the vehicle strings that produce is visible in the morning, right? Whether it's, the mental vehicle associated with the sound form Hesperus is not connected to the vehicles that produce verbal output is visible in the morning. That structure isn't stored. And this accounts for the relevant pattern in the data. When asked whether he would like to view Hesperus in the morning, the subject here's the word Hesperus, and thus the Hesperus specific vehicle is activated, and it leads to Hesperus specific response. It controls this response. It says that's impossible. So there's a kind of revisionism here, you might think. You know, what we have done is we've explained this, how the system as a whole exhibits intentional behavior, which is the explanandum to be accounted for. But we haven't done it in the way Hutto and Mayan expect. We haven't done it in terms of meaning, right? It's not the meaning that explains this intentional behavior, as I'm calling it, this kind of contradiction in our subject's behavior. When he says he wants to go see this thing in the morning, it'd be lovely to go see Phosphorus, but he thinks it's impossible to see that very same thing in the morning, right? That's weird behavior. We've accounted for it without appeal to content. And that may bother Hutto and Mayan, but that doesn't undermine the fact that it has been accounted for. So the explanation given may not be what we would expect pre-scientifically, and it's more consistent with a flattened architecture of the sort I described in yesterday's lecture, in which models of behavior of interest can include both factors associated with the content of one of our belief states or more, and factors at what would normally be thought of as the subpersonal level, facts about the meaning independent individuation of cognitive vehicles. Right there in the same model, you can have sort of facts about the neurologically individuated vehicles or vehicles that are individuated syntactically without concern for their meaning. They can be right there alongside the relational facts that determine representation. They can be part of the same model and contribute together or in different proportions to the production of behavior. So from a naturalistic perspective, such unexpected accounts, such revisionism are not surprising. I'll wrap up in just a sec. Concluding remarks. Here we go. Naturalistic inquiry into a non-fundamental phenomenon such as mental representation is likely to produce unexpected results. To the extent that there are representations, they can be whatever structures or relations earn their causal explanatory keep in cognitive science by accounting for the relevant data, so long as the naturalist isn't entirely changing the subject. But the naturalist isn't doing so in the present case, because the structures identified as representations account for the phenomena of misrepresentation, error, accuracy, inaccuracy, that family of things, as well as intentionality. And they participate in processes that produce the behavior pre-theoretically thought to be explained by representations, like inference and planning and counterfactual reasoning. And so it seems like it would be unfair to say that we're changing the subject here. All right, I'll wrap things up there. Thanks very much.